We've been working our way through Mark's gospel, and that's where we're going to be this morning. I'll be honest, after this week's events, I kept thinking, well, I need to change this. If you don't know, I choose sermons way ahead of time. I can tell you what I'm preaching this week next year. That's just kind of how I operate. And so I choose these texts and choose the congregational readings, and every once in a while they'll fluctuate a little bit, but not really. And I'm just amazed over and over again how God works through His Word, that no matter what kind of situation we're going on, I mean, seriously, a week ago, who knew that we were going to be here in this kind of situation? And so I thought, well, I'm gonna dump the text. Even last night, I was sitting around going, yeah, I've got to find something else to preach on. And so I read through this text and I went, no, this is exactly what I need to do. Because we're going to be talking a little bit about how Jesus becomes king. And Clyde, I'm sorry, but that's... The glare from your forehead is getting me, and it has nothing to do with your hair. There you go. Oh, my. I love you, brother. Mark's going to be talking about how Jesus becomes king. And Jesus becomes king in a number of ways, and he's still king. And he was king in the turmoil of the first century, and he's king in the turmoil of the 21st century. It doesn't matter what's going on around us, he's still king. And if he is our king, it demands that we operate in a certain way, that we live our lives in a certain way. And it doesn't matter what's going on around us. We're still called to be Christians. Whether you can do that at school or do that on an extra long spring break, you're still called to do that. Whether you do that at work as a waitress or all of a sudden now you're a short order cook passing stuff out of a drive-thru, you're still called to do that. And whether you're out in the oil field or stuck at home, you're still called to do that. So even though the kingdom changes that we are living in, the kingdom that we're really citizens of doesn't change. So how do we adapt to the world around us? How do we make sure that we are always doing what God has called us to do? It has to do something with how God becomes king, how Jesus becomes king. Now, we've been looking at Mark's gospel again for several weeks. We started out with the question of, who is this Jesus? Mark tells you right off the bat, well, he's the Messiah. But then he spends the next 8 or so chapters trying to explain that to you and get you to see the same thing. And finally, Peter, one of his closest friends, gets it. And then we figure out, he sort of gets it. Because Peter's idea of Jesus being the Messiah is very different than Jesus' idea of being the Messiah. And Peter learns pretty quickly, okay, this is different than I think it is. And so Jesus, in the middle of Mark's gospel, he's kind of teaching us, what does it mean to be the Messiah? And he teaches us 3 different times that being the Messiah means that he's going to go to Jerusalem, that he's going to be turned over to the authorities, that he's going to be beaten, that he's going to be crucified, that he's going to die. And then he's going to come back to life. Now, who's ready to inaugurate our next president that way, huh? Yeah, right. Nobody becomes powerful that way. To be handed over and tried and accused and arrested. No. It's crazy. But in God's upside down kingdom, it makes perfect sense. When we look at the ministry of Jesus, when we look at the life of Jesus through the way of this world, it looks upside down. But it's not upside down. We're upside down. We're looking at it the wrong way. So Jesus slowly is teaching, what does it mean to be a part of that? Mark does this really cool thing in his gospel as he goes toward the end of this that we really don't pick up on because none of us have seen a Caesar become Caesar. And we've seen presidential parades. Those are cool. You know, we've heard the speeches on the Capitol steps. And yeah, that's cool. We tend to stop school and watch it. That's chaos usually with kids. But we don't understand how Caesar took over. The readers of Mark's gospel did. And Mark tells the story of how Jesus becomes king, and it's awfully similar to the way that Caesar comes to power, but in an upside-down kind of way. whether we're here or whether we're not, we're going to look at that together over the next couple of weeks. It's a really cool story. But this morning, we're going to look at a parable that Jesus tells about what it means to be part of a kingdom when it seems that God's not around. When it seems that he's gone away and he's left us and we're off to our own creations, what does it look like to be God's people? And that's a message that we do need today. That when the world is going crazy and hoarding toilet paper, I know who you are. When the world's going crazy, the people of God are called to act a certain way. How are we supposed to act? And Jesus fills us in on that a little bit. So let's read a little bit, starting in Mark chapter 12. We're going to start in verse 1, and then we'll come back around and talk about it a bit. Context of this. Chapter 11, Jesus rides into town. We call it the triumphal entry. Know that I'm taking this a little bit out of order. We'll talk about that in a couple of weeks on Palm Sunday. But know that Jesus has made a very public statement before this of who he thinks he is. He rides into town like a king. And people praise him as a king. And he does some things that acts like he's in charge. And people are questioning his authority. And so he's in and around Jerusalem. He's in and around the temple courts. And this is where he starts teaching this parable. Jesus then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the wine press, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another one, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son, whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read the passage of Scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Then the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders looked for a way to arrest him, because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. Now you're going to have to reach back in the depths of your memory to this fall. We were going through the Old Testament. We were looking at the prophets. And hopefully something rang a bell with you when I read the first words of Jesus about a man had a vineyard and planted a vineyard and dug a wine press and put a watchtower in it. Because Jesus starts out his story, his parable, to teach people about his kingdom the exact same way that Isaiah does his vineyard song in Isaiah chapter 5. And we looked at that a while back. And in Isaiah chapter 5, the point of it is that the stewards of the vineyard had not done well. That God had planted this vineyard. He had given it the perfect grapes, but yet what's yielded is lousy grapes. Not good for anything. So God, the owner of the vineyard, what's he going to do? Tear it down. And what came to pass after Isaiah telling Israel about that? God tore down the vineyard. Jerusalem was overtaken. The people of Israel were hauled off to captivity, and they were punished for not bearing the fruit that God had designed for them to bear. So when Jesus starts his parable by quoting that, all the good Bible students in the audience, which was all of them, because they didn't have Facebook or Twitter or whatever else, they sat around and read their Bible, or heard it, or recited it, or memorized it. When Jesus starts telling the story, they're going, oh, he's telling Isaiah 5, but not exactly. It's a little bit different. This time, instead of focusing on the grapes, he focuses on those who are supposed to be taking care of the grapes. And we get an image here that's different than our world. But you probably studied something in your history classes in school that is similar. Sharecroppers. Some of you may have even worked in a system like this, that where those who want to work a piece of property but don't own it come to an agreement with the one who owns the land. I'm going to farm it, I'm going to plant stuff, and you'll get a share of whatever I get as payment for that. Very common in this country in one day and time. Not as much anymore, although I've got a family member who does that with hay. That somebody gets to take part of it, and they get to take part of it based on the land. So the idea here is that the workers of the vineyard, the tenants of the vineyard, are supposed to do the work, and then the owner of the vineyard is supposed to get a cut of it. It's not wrong to ask for it. It's not a gift. It's an obligation. Because the owner of the vineyard owns it. It's his. And the problem is the owners of the vineyard don't want to give to the owner what is rightfully the owner's. They think, I like it the way I like it. And if I just ignore you, I can do whatever I want to do. Folks, we're planted in a vineyard. You may not think of Snyder, Texas as a vineyard, but you're in God's vineyard. You've been planted exactly where God wants you for such a time as this. You're exactly where you're supposed to be. And the owner of the vineyard expects certain things to happen. How are we going to react? Are we going to ignore the fact that he owns everything and just do it the way we want to? Are we going to give to God what is rightfully God's? That's kind of the problem that's being wrestled with here. And they don't want to give to God what is rightfully God's. And we can ask ourselves, well, what is rightfully God's? Is it our time? Yeah. Is it our money? Yeah. Is it our praise? Yeah. Is it our relationships? Yeah. Is it the way we treat our neighbor? Yeah. Is it the way that we look out for one another by not hugging one another or kissing on one another? Yeah. It can be any number of things. Always keep in mind the greatest commands. We're called to love our God by loving our neighbors as ourselves. And in such a time as this, that's very prevalent. The owners of this vineyard don't want to give to God what is God's. They're the toilet paper hoarders. They're wanting to keep it all for themselves. They're wanting to just, it's mine, I'm going to hang on to it, I don't care. So God sends some people. And they beat them and they kill them. And if you're wondering what people these are, you're holding their writings in your hand. The prophets, most of them were beaten or killed or turned away or lived awful lives because they were representatives of God saying, give to God what is God's. People don't like that message. They beat him and they kill him. So Jesus tells them that God decided to send his son. It's kind of interesting that Jesus is telling this parable about himself. He sent me. And what's going to happen? They're going to kill him too. What's the result of that? It's not good. He reminds us in a way, we don't own the property. We're just tenants here. The idea that we just get Jesus out of the way and we'll be okay, doesn't work that way. Because we don't own it. We think we own it. I've got a piece of paper that says I own my house, but I really don't. God does. And everything we think we own, God owns it. And if you think, well, yeah, but I have control over it. Really? After this week? Really? You think you do? This parable and this world's events recently are a good reminder of who's really in control. We like to pretend that we're in control. Y'all know James. My son James, not the other ones around here. He loves to think he's in control. He loves to climb up in front of the TV and get this far away from it and block everybody else out because it's mine. These aren't my boots I'm wearing. They're James's, according to him. It's not my food on my plate that I'm trying to eat. It's his because he's taking it out of my mouth. Sometimes we're just like James. God's very patient with us. But every now and again, we need a thump on the head to remind us it's not yours. You've been called to do something. And are you going to give to God what is God's? Jesus applies this to the people, and he goes to Psalm 118. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at Psalm 118. But he goes to the passage that says, the cornerstone, the stone that the builders have rejected. They said, this isn't it. I'm not going to be able to build a house using this. It's worthless. That's exactly how God's going to build his house. And everybody understood that Psalm 118 was a messianic psalm, that it talked about the coming of the Messiah. But it's not us that's going to reject him. It's everybody else out there that's the problem. It's not us. Yet who's Jesus preaching this to? Church people. The people who are in the temple courts. They all read it as, oh, it's all those people out there that the problem is. But sometimes we have to look in the mirror to see who the problem is. Do our actions, do our words, do our relationships, do our Facebook posts, do they accurately represent whose we are? And in every one of those situations, are we accurately saying we are giving to God what is God's? Or are we rejecting that cornerstone and trying to build our own structure? People around Jesus decided how they were going to react. They decided they wanted to arrest him. They just want to get rid of him, which is ironic because what's the parable about? If you try to do that, you're going to get messed up. And then Mark sticks in another story right after this that for a long time I thought it's not related. It is. Let's look at it together. Starting in verse 13. Later, they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. We're going to pause right there, because that's one of those verses that we love to just read past and go, okay. You have no idea what that says. Pharisees were your religious and political conservatives. They thought that Roman rule was sinful. They didn't want any part of it. They didn't want to deal with Caesar. They didn't want anything to do with him. As a matter of fact, why are there money changers in the temple? Because we're not even going to use that money. Because that money has the graven image of Caesar on it. And the money was also stamped saying that Caesar is God and that he is the high priest. It's sinful on all levels just to have the money, was their opinion. And then you've got the Herodians. The Herodians are strong supporters of Caesar. They really like the fact that Caesar in Rome is in control of us and he gives us a puppet king called Herod to rule over us. They're very much in favor of the Roman system. They love the fact that Caesar is in control. And notice that these two groups who can't stand each other come together to deal with the problem of Jesus. If this tells you about their hearts, it ought to be a wake-up call. Because you have radical socialists and radical conservatives working together. That's how much they want to put an end to Jesus. And so they devised this scheme that they're going to ask him a little question about what they all have to do. Look at verse 14. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we pay?" Now, this shows the level of their hypocrisy. Because if Jesus says, yes, you should pay the tax to Caesar, knowing what the money says, the Pharisees can charge Jesus with blasphemy. If he puts his faith in that system and that money and thinks that we ought to support that, he's worshiping a god other than the one true God. Blasphemy, kill him. And the Herodians, if Jesus goes, no, you don't support the machine, that's graven image, that's an idol you're carrying around in your pocket. Don't pay that to Caesar. Caesar's not God. He's in rebellion against the empire. He's a traitor. Put him to death. They've got him, don't they? And both sides, knowing each other is on the other side, are perfectly okay with whatever answer it is because it solves their problem. Welcome to Washington 101. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me? He asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. Which tells you what? Jesus doesn't have one. There's the Pharisees' problem. He doesn't even have a coin. They brought him the coin and he asked them, whose image is this? Whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. And Jesus said to them, then give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. And they were amazed at him. Caesar claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed to be divine. He claimed to be the high priest, the way that you worshiped in the Roman Empire. Jesus doesn't have his coin. Doesn't work. Yet that coin does not belong to anybody other than the empire. It's not mine. It clearly belongs to Caesar because it's got his picture on it. Give it to him. You give to God what is God's. Remember back to August when we were looking at the book of Genesis. Whose image is God stamped on? And God made them in his image. Male and female, he created them. And he gave them authority to rule over the realm he put them in. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. Subdue it. Rule over it. And he still hasn't canceled the design that he made for us. We've complicated the work by our choices. But if Genesis teaches us anything, it's that you were made in the image of God for a purpose. And during this season, we're going to have to give to Caesar what is Caesar's. We're going to have to do things differently. We're going to have to not travel some. We're going to have to not work some. We're going to have to sit at home some. We're going to have to use the internet more, even though I don't like computers. We're going to have to. We live in the system. We're going to have to give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But don't you dare for a moment think that you can get away with not giving to God what is God's. You are made in the image of God. No matter what happens, you have a mission to carry out. The tenants didn't want to give to God what is rightfully God's. We're reminded there, and we're reminded through the parable of the taxes. That's exactly the mission that we've been given. So this morning I ask you, have you given to God what is God's? Or are you like the tenants trying to keep everything the way that you want it for yourself? We know how that ends. It's not pretty. We do know that Jesus is still on the throne. And we know that God is once again going to send his son to claim whatever it is that is his. Are you going to be a part of that or not? Consequences are real. So we're going to sing an invitation song this morning. And if you need to give to God what is God's, whatever it is, whether it be your life, committing to him, being baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, starting a new life in his kingdom, or whether that may be repenting of trying to keep it all for yourself, whatever it is, give to God what is God's as we stand, as we sing.